Blessings of the Triple Gem, Theruwan Saranai. Welcome back to another Sutta Meditation Series Dhamma live stream. Heartfelt good wishes to everyone joining. This is part two of our Vesak Dhamma session on the Tathagata. And in part one, we looked at why it is difficult and rare for a Buddha to appear in the world. We specifically examined what is a Buddha, why is he called the Tathagata, what is the process for becoming a future Buddha. And we also looked into some of the unique qualities of a Buddha. In this session, we will continue to examine some further suttas in support of what makes a Buddha incomparable to others, and to refresh our minds about the good quality of saddha, so that's conviction or faith in the Buddha, and more. So let's begin by again paying respects to the Triple Gem. We can bow our heads and join our hands in Anjali. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Noble Sangha. So let's look at what we'll cover in this session. So we'll look at how to get the best out of this session. Again, our usual tips and reminders. Then we'll look at the Tathagata and bhikkhus liberated by wisdom, other teachers, Brahmins, and wanderers. So some selected suttas that support the superiority of the Buddha compared to others. We'll then also look at the importance of conviction in the Tathagata, because understanding all these things about the Tathagata, especially on a Vesak day, it's good to remind ourselves of the different aspects of conviction, but in a broad sense. Then we'll look at some further qualities of the Buddha that support conviction. So this is the Ithipisogatha, to refresh our minds of that, including a short meditation, so meditation on Buddhanusati. And then we'll look at some of the dangers of slandering the noble ones and slandering the Buddha. And we'll take the opportunity to ask for forgiveness as well. And then we'll close with sharing the merit and the blessings. So let's begin. So again, how to get the best out of this session? Keep an open mind. So as you know, there's always things that come up, and we need to be open and attentive to the Buddha's words in this discourse in terms of what we're going to cover today, but also that's just generally the instructions that the Buddha is giving us. And be okay with not understanding everything or not potentially agreeing with everything right away. So whatever you take from this session is probably what you need right now. And remember that we're all sekhas, we're all learners, so we're here to lean on each other. And it doesn't matter if there's one person, two people, three people, or even more. It's fine. We're here to walk this path together. And today's such an auspicious day. I'm just so happy to be talking the Buddha's words. And then let's apply ourselves to the Buddha's words themselves. So in this session, we'll have an opportunity to connect with the Buddha's words. Particularly, we're going to do a meditation on Buddhanusati. And when we meditate, we probably won't need to use our own examples, but to take what we've gone through, if you were here for part one, but also whatever we are inspired by in terms of the Buddha's journey and the effort and all the perfections that it took as the Bodhisattva to get to the point of a perfectly enlightened Buddha, a Sammasambuddha. So in that way, when we do this Buddhanusati meditation, we see the Buddha. And in seeing the Buddha, we see the Dhamma. So as we begin our session, let's have good wishes for everyone. Let's have good wishes for all the people that helped us to walk this path and to be here today. So a question that is often asked is if there is a difference between the enlightenment of a Buddha and a noble disciple of the Buddha. And the Buddha addresses this in the Sammasambuddha Sutta, which is Sanyutta Nikaya, chapter 22, discourse number 58, where he declares that the Tathagata and a bhikkhu liberated by wisdom are both liberated by non-clinging through revulsion towards the five aggregates through its fading away and cessation, And then the Buddha poses the question, therein bhikkhus, what is the distinction? What is the disparity? What is the difference between the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, and a bhikkhu liberated by wisdom? And he answers as follows. The Tathagata bhikkhus, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, is the originator of the path unarisen before, the producer of the path unproduced before, the declarer of the path undeclared before. He is the knower of the path, the discoverer of the path, the one skilled in the path. And his disciples now dwell following that path and become possessed of it afterwards. This bhikkhus is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, and a bhikkhu liberated by wisdom. So we see it's confirmed in this very clear language how the Buddha is the originator, producer, declarer, knower, discoverer, and one skilled in the path to liberation. And no one else can actually make that claim. And everyone that follows the path comes after the Buddha. So we can rightly say that the Buddha is superior. Now the next sutta is the Gopakamoggallana Sutta, and this appears in the Middle Length Discourses, so Majjhima Nikaya Discourse number 108. And this was not long after the Blessed One had attained final Nibbana. So Venerable Ananda was questioned by the Brahmin Gopakamoggallana about the Sangha of Bhikkhus. And so he says, Master Ananda, is there any single bhikkhu who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by Master Gautama, accomplished and fully enlightened? And Venerable Ananda says, there is no single bhikkhu, Brahmin, who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. For the Blessed One was the arouser of the unarisen path, the producer of the unproduced path, the declarer of the undeclared path. He was the knower of the path, the finder of the path, and the one skilled in the path. But his disciples now abide following that path and become possessed of it afterwards. So the same statement that was in the Sammasambuddha sutta that we just read out before. So we see even at the time of the Buddha or shortly after his passing, there was no single bhikkhu who possessed all of the Buddha's qualities in each and every way. So this should now make sense, given what we covered in part one of our Vesak live stream, regarding the difficulty for a Buddha to appear in the world, but also for a bhikkhu in one lifetime to match that of a Buddha, a Sammasambuddha. So only another Buddha would be able to match the qualities of Gautama Buddha, although there are some different peculiarities around that, which we won't go into today. But the main thing is when people ask the question whether an Arahant in this lifetime matches the Buddha, and the answer is very clear. It's not possible to match. They may have some of the Buddha jnanas, but of course, as we know, the Buddha would have the 73 knowledges and the different powers and various different marks, and would have gone through 100,000 eons and at least 4 asankhyas of rebirth in order to fulfill the 10 perfections and more. And Venerable Ananda repeats, of course, that same statement about the Buddha being an originator of the path, declarer, and so on. So if you take that into your mind, it's a very, very powerful statement. And it dispels a lot of these doubts and uncertainties that come to people's minds about the Buddha. So we now come to the Uttara Vipatti Sutta, which is in Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 8, discourse number 8. And this is where Venerable Uttara is approached by Sakka, king of the Tavatinsa Deva realm, about whether Venerable Uttara had been teaching the bhikkhus about the benefit of reviewing one's own failings from time to time, as well as the failings of others, one's own achievements and the achievements of others. And Venerable Uttara replied in the affirmative when Sakka had asked this question. But then Sakka asked Venerable Uttara, but Bhante, Was this your own discernment, or was it the word of the Blessed One, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one? And then Venerable Uttara says, well then, ruler of the Devas, I will give you a simile. Even by means of a simile, some intelligent people understand the meaning of what has been said. Suppose not far from a village or town, there was a great heap of grain, and a large crowd of people were to take away grain with carrying poles, baskets, hip sacks, and their cupped hands. If someone were to approach that large crowd of people and ask them, where did you get this grain? What should they say? And then, Bhante, these people should say, we got it from that great heap of grain. So too, ruler of the Devas, whatever is well spoken is all the word of the Blessed One, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. I myself and others derive our good words from him. And then Sakka, king of the Devas, says, it's astounding and amazing, Bhante, how well you stated this. Whatever is well spoken is all the word of the Blessed One, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. I myself and others derive our good words from him. So here we see a bhikkhu affirm in another way that any wise teachings or words that are well spoken in Dhamma are all words of the Buddha. And it's very important to reflect on this response from Venerable Uttara. For one, it's so truthful. And there's a genuine sense of honoring and respecting the Buddha as a perfectly enlightened one. And when it comes to wisdom, knowledge, and insight, it's hard to fathom anyone in the world coming close to what the Buddhas have perfected. And so these wise words that we hear in the world even today, even the best kind of Dhamma talk, even the most rousing of sense of urgency, or even clarity, at the end of the day, they all come from the Buddhas. And so that's also something that I take to heart when I read out the Buddha's words, or even when I try and understand them or express them or explain them. I think, well, even if it ends up sounding really good or it's clear for people to understand, I always remember this particular sutta because it all comes from the Buddha. And there are other suttas where different arahants, different noble disciples of the Buddha express the same thing, maybe in a slightly different way, but this exact same thing. And so there's something very honorable about that, very wonderful. And of course, when you think about it that way, it helps to remove the conceit that any of us may have when we share Dhamma with one person, with two people, with 20 people, with 100 people or more, that there is humility. And in remembering also that we're seekers, like in my own case, I'm not an arahant. So anything that comes out, whether it's praised or what have you, it's all due to the noble ones, all due to specifically the Buddha. So then whenever the Buddha encountered particularly Brahmins, who are practicing their belief of the validity of the Vedic scriptures and accomplishments of their ancient Vedic seers. And the Buddha would often challenge them. You find so many suttas, particularly in Majjhima Nikaya and the chapter on Brahmins. And one particular example is this Chanki Sutta, which is in Majjhima Nikaya discourse number 95. It's a good example of how he would challenge the Brahmins. And this one, it starts with saying, so Bharadvaja, it seems that among the Brahmins, there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among the Brahmins, the Buddha goes on to say, there is not even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher back to the seventh generation of teachers who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, even these ancient Brahmin seers do not say thus, we know this, we see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And he gives this simile, suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, And the last one does not see. So too, Bharadvaja, in regard to this statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. And the Buddha is really pointing to direct insight and being able to directly know and see what is true, and also that anything else is wrong. And as we know, the Buddha has perfected the perfection of truthfulness. So there's something that appears when we look at earlier on in part one, the Loka Sutta, because the Brahmins that came to see the Buddha, they were relying on their lineage. But that lineage, as the Buddha revealed, had no direct insight into how things really are. So he was prompting and asking questions of this particular Brahmin in the Chanki Sutta. And so the Buddha rightly gave the simile of the blind leading the blind, in which the first, middle, and last do not have any direct insight into the truth. So in contrast, if you remember that Loka Sutta, so Anguttara Nikaya chapter 4, discourse number 23, the Buddha is someone who whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, examined by the mind, all that the Tathagata has fully awakened to. So the Buddha has direct insight and knowledge and wisdom. And also, in that same sutta, as the Tathagata speaks, so he does. As he does, so he speaks. So there's no falsity or deception, no hypocrisy when it comes to the actions through body, speech, and mind of the Buddha. So how is this possible for the Buddha? It's really because of the very long period, 100,000 eons and a minimum of 4 asaṅkhyas spent fulfilling the perfections as the Bodhisattva. So we now come to the Lohicha Sutta, which is in Digha Nikaya, discourse number 12. And the Buddha is talking to Brahman Lohicha about qualities of 3 blameworthy teachers who deserve to be reprimanded. And the first blameworthy teacher is a teacher who has gone forth from the household life into homelessness, but who has not gained the goal. And without having gained this goal, he teaches his disciples a doctrine saying, this is for your good, this is for your happiness. But his pupils don't wish to hear, they don't listen, they don't arouse the thought of enlightenment, and the teacher's instructions are flouted. It is just as if a man were to persist in making advances to a woman who rejected him and to embrace her though she turned away. That's the consequence of such a wicked, greedy deed, I say. For what can one do for another? And this is the first kind of teacher who deserves to be reprimanded. And so the Buddha then talks about this second blameworthy teacher. So it's a teacher who has gone forth from household life into homelessness, but who has not gained the goal. And without having gained this goal, he teaches his disciples a doctrine saying, this is for your good, this is for your happiness. But his pupils wish to hear in this respect. They listen and they rouse up the thought of enlightenment, and the teacher's instructions are not flouted. And so he gives a different simile saying, it is as if leaving his own field, he should think another's field in need of weeding. And so again, he says that's a consequence of such a wicked, greedy deed, I say, for what can one do for another? And this is the second kind of teacher who deserves to be reprimanded. And then this third one is the blameworthy teacher. So a teacher who has gone forth from household life into homelessness and who has gained the goal. And having gained the goal, he teaches his disciples a doctrine saying, this is for your good and this is for your happiness. But his pupils don't wish to hear. They don't listen. They don't arouse the thought of enlightenment, and the teacher's instructions are flouted. Just as if having cut through an old fetter, one were to make a new one. And that's the consequence of such a greedy, wicked deed, I say, for what can one person do for another? This is the third kind of teacher who deserves to be reprimanded. So very interesting similes, I thought, when I was reading through this, and they're very good to reflect also after this session, because these similes need to sit in one's mind, and particularly when the mind is calm, So I found these particularly interesting for those who share Dhamma. Now I know this, these three instances talk about people that have gone forth. But I think even when you share Dhamma with others, whether it's just to one person or whether it's to a small group or to a large audience, it's also worth reflecting upon because of the different kinds of Dhamma teachers in the world today, and also to ensure that one is not someone that is blameworthy. When it comes to making karma, this is something that Buddha always highlights about making sure someone is blameless and not blameworthy. And so Lohicha asked the Buddha, Reverend Gautama, are there any teachers in the world who are not blameworthy? And the Buddha replies, Here, Lohicha, a Tathagata arises in the world, an Arahant, fully enlightened Buddha, endowed with wisdom and conduct, welfarer, knower of the world, incomparable, trainer of men to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. So this is the Itipisogata. He, having realized it by his own super knowledge, proclaims this world with its devas, maras and brahmas, its princes and people. He preaches the Dhamma, which is lovely in its beginning, lovely in its middle, lovely in its end, in the spirit and in the letter, and displays the fully perfected and purified holy life. A disciple goes forth and practices the moralities, guards the sense doors, attains the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. They extend and project the mind toward knowledge and vision. They understand there is no return to any state of existence. And whenever the pupil of a teacher attains to such excellent distinction, that is a teacher who is not to be blamed in the world. And if anyone blames that teacher, his blame is improper, untrue, not in accordance with reality, and faulty. Whenever the pupil of a teacher attains to such excellent distinction, that is a teacher who is not to be blamed in the world. And if anyone blames that teacher, his blame is improper, untrue, not in accordance with reality, and faulty. So as we know from the qualities of the Buddha, this is the Itipisogata, and also the Buddha is this unsurpassed trainer or teacher of people fit to be trained or tamed, the teacher of devas and humans. So this is what is being articulated in the Buddha's explanation of someone who is blameless, who doesn't deserve to be reprimanded. And the proof that he's giving is in what the trainees practice, in how they attain to the noble path in accordance with the Buddha's instructions and eventually to reach the ultimate goal. And of course, this noble path, it originates with the Buddha. It's being declared by the Buddha, known and discovered by the Buddha. And he is the one that's perfectly skilled in the path. So it's an interesting sutta, this one, to look at, because the Buddha provides some comparisons. And having been through the lengthy journey to become a future Buddha, you can see that it's very difficult to outclass, outdo a Buddha, a perfectly enlightened Buddha. So many of the obstructions that we have are actually down to conceit and arrogance. And this is whether we know it or not. And we often knowingly or unknowingly have this towards the Buddha. That's why a session like this today is very good for clearing up some of our doubts, also correcting some of our misrepresentations of the Buddha, or even our value judgments of the Buddha. So during the Buddha's time, certain Brahmins would come and debate and argue with the Buddha. And on one occasion, the Brahmin student Subha came to visit the Buddha to discuss the value of different kinds of work and what is fruitful and various other matters. And in this teaching, the Buddha again uses the I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So the direct insight challenge that we examined earlier in the Chanki Sutta. And he's referring to being able to realize the truth with one's own direct insight, not like the blind leading the blind. So afterwards, when the Brahmin Subha, having spoken to the Buddha and he was on his way home, he encountered the Brahmin Janusoni, which reveals much about how the Brahmin Subha no longer held the same kind of conceit that he had at the beginning of the discourse following their interaction. So I'll read out this this last part of the sutta, and it says, now on that occasion, the Brahmin Janasoni was driving out of Sarvathi in the middle of the day in an all-white chariot drawn by white mares. He saw the Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, coming in the distance and asked him, now where is Master Bharadaja coming from in the middle of the day? And then he gets the response, sir, I'm coming from the presence of the recluse Gautama. And then he further asks, what does Master Bharadaja think of the recluse Gautama's lucidity of wisdom? He is wise, is he not? And Subha replies, sir, who am I to know the recluse Gautama's lucidity of wisdom? One would surely have to be his equal to know the recluse Gautama's lucidity of wisdom. And then the Brahmin Janasoni asks a further question, or actually makes a comment. Master Bharadaja praises the recluse Gautama with high praise indeed. And then Subha replies, sir, who am I to praise the recluse Gautama? The recluse Gautama is praised by the praised as the best among gods and humans. And then when this was said, the Brahmin Janasoni got down from his all-white chariot, drawn by white mares, and after arranging his robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and uttered this exclamation. It is a gain for King Pasanadi of Kosala. It is a great gain for King Pasanadi of Kosala that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, lives in his realm. So we see here the Brahmin Subha recognizing the superiority of the Buddha and the Brahmin Janasoni also recognizing that also. So this is a good example to take into our minds because we can also knowingly and unknowingly fall into wrong views and attitudes towards the Buddha, which are very obstructive to the path. In many ways, we can be our own worst enemies when we question, make problems out of things, and even become quite dismissive and to the extent of even insulting towards such a perfectly enlightened being. So that there's a certain amount of care that needs to be taken as well as to lower ourselves in terms of the conceit and to make ourselves aware when we do that even in our mind. So then we look at what do Buddhas honor and respect? So there are many more examples from interactions with Brahmins and wanderers and kings and even Sangha in terms of their interactions with the Buddha and also in the comparisons with the Buddha, but we'll leave those ones there for now and look at this. And what we can look at is what the Buddhas honor and revere and venerate. So in this Pathama Uruvela Sutta, which is shortly after the Buddha attains full enlightenment, so this is in Anguttara Nikaya chapter 4, discourse number 21. And the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, on one occasion I was dwelling at Uruvela by the goatherd's banyan tree on the bank of the Naranjara River, just after I had attained full enlightenment. Then, while I was alone in seclusion, a course of thought arose in my mind thus. It is painful to dwell without reverence and deference. Now what ascetic or Brahmin can I honour, respect and dwell in dependence on? And then it occurred to me, if my aggregate of virtuous behaviour were incomplete, for the sake of completing it, I would honour, respect and dwell in dependence on another ascetic or Brahmin. However, in this world, with its Devas, Mara and Brahma, among this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its Devas and humans, I do not see another ascetic or Brahmin more accomplished in virtuous behaviour than myself, whom I could honour, respect and dwell in dependence on. And then he says the same thing in relation to his aggregate of concentration and also his aggregate of wisdom. And then when it comes to the aggregate of liberation as well, so these four things. And so he couldn't see any other ascetic or Brahmin more accomplished in these four things. And so he then says, it occurred to me, let me then honour, respect and dwell in dependence only on this Dhamma to which I have become fully enlightened. And so this is how the Buddha and other Buddhas have come to honour and respect and dwell in dependence only on this Dhamma from which he had become fully enlightened. And we know this because then Brahmasahampati, having known with his own mind the reflection in my mind, He disappeared from the Brahma world and reappeared before me just as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm or draw in his extended arm. He arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, bent down with his right knee on the ground, reverently saluted me and said, "So it is, blessed one, so it is, fortunate one, Bhante. Those who are arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones in the past, those blessed ones too, honored, respected, and dwelled in dependence only on the Dhamma." And then he says the same thing for the Buddhas in the future. And he also says the same thing for the Buddhas at present. They all honor, respect, and dwell in dependence only on the Dhamma. And then this is what Brahmasahamnipi said. And having said this, he further said, "The perfect Buddhas of the past, the Buddhas of the future, and the present Buddha who removes the sorrow of many, all those dwelled now dwell, and in the future will dwell, revering the good Dhamma. This is the nature of the Buddhas. Therefore, one desiring the good, aspiring for greatness, should revere the good Dhamma, recollecting the Buddha's teaching." This was what Brahmasahamnipi said. He then paid homage to me, keeping me on his right. He disappeared right there. Then, having acknowledged Brahma's request and what was proper for myself, I honored, respected, and dwelled in dependence only on the Dhamma to which I had become fully enlightened. And now that the Sangha has acquired greatness, I have respect for the Sangha too. So this is a good reminder for us to honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on the Triple Gem in our case, to regularly recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, in line with how the Buddha has instructed us to do so. So in our sessions today, we have been arousing conviction or faith, saddha in Pali, in the Buddha. This is vital towards developing the Bodhipakya Dhammas. And we know that conviction or faith is one of the five spiritual faculties, so the pancha indriya, one of the four streams of merit, so punya dhara, one of the five spiritual powers, so pancha bala, five elements of exertion, so padaniyanga, and also one of the seven riches or wealth, so dana. So in the Vimamsaka Sutta, which is in Majjhima Nikaya Discourse number 47, the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, when anyone's conviction has been planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms, and phrases, his conviction is said to be supported by reasons, rooted in insight or understanding, firm. It is invincible by any recluse or Brahman or God or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world." And we also know from the Chanki Sutta that we've referenced a number of times today, how the Buddha challenges and refutes baseless or irrational conviction, so blind conviction or rootless conviction. In Pali, this is known as amulika saddha. So in today's sessions, we've been cultivating conviction that is planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata. It's been supported by better understanding what it really means to become a Buddha, how difficult it is to appear in the world for a Buddha, and to realize these superior qualities of such a being, all the past Buddhas as well as all the future Buddhas. So this kind of conviction has the characteristics of being able to trust, to have confidence in, to be able to rely upon the Buddha, and then also the Dhamma and the Sangha. And this only comes from having brightness in the mind, a certain level of clarity which is associated with conviction. And if you remember from the Nagaropama Sutta, which we look at when we talk about the Seka qualities, the trainee qualities in the Seka Patipada Sutta, particularly the seven good qualities, Saddha is the first of those seven good qualities, represented by the citadel or the fortress's pillar with the deep foundations. So when we consider this pillar with deep foundations, it has to be well dug, it has to be well established in the ground. Otherwise, if it's not, it will shake, it will become unstable. So in this way, what we've been doing for the number of hours that we've been together, it's been about developing this conviction in the perfectly enlightened Buddha, and we don't want to shake with any of the conditions in the world. Any of these worldly conditions will not shake us, will not make us unstable as we walk this Noble Eightfold Path. Now in the Saddha Sutta, which is Anguttara Nikaya chapter 5, discourse number 38, the Buddha teaches that there are five benefits that come to a clansman endowed with conviction. And he says, the first one is when good persons in the world show compassion. They first show compassion to the person with conviction, not so to the person without conviction. The second is when they approach anyone, they first approach the person with conviction, not so the person without conviction. The third is when they receive alms, they first receive alms from the person with conviction, not so from the person without conviction. The fourth is when they teach the Dhamma, they first teach the Dhamma to the person with conviction, not so the person without conviction. That one reminds me of when Brahmasahampati talks about there are people with a little dust in their eyes. So these are the people with some conviction. And then the fifth one is, with the breakup of the body after death, a person with conviction is reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. These are the five benefits that come to a clansman who has conviction. Just as at a crossroads on level ground, a great banyan tree becomes the resort for birds all around. So the clansman endowed with conviction becomes the resort for many people, for bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, male lay followers and female lay followers. And so when we think about our Kalyanamittas who do have a very strong foundation established for conviction, for this saddha towards the Buddha, you can see people naturally gravitate towards them, and rightly so. So one of the things we do know is that conviction or saddha increases with right view. We know this because when we look at the Upanissa Sutta, which is Sanyutta Nikaya chapter 12, discourse number 23, dukkha is the nutriment for saddha. So if we correctly understand the universal truth about dukkha, not personal dukkha, but the universal predicament that we face and this whole mass of suffering, then we establish right view. And with right view, that means we can gain wisdom about how things really are. And with that wisdom, we gain more conviction towards the Buddha. So we now know from various discourses, and we've studied this before, that there are good qualities, powers, and spiritual faculties of conviction. And it's when a noble disciple is endowed with conviction in the enlightenment of the Tathagata. So if a person is practicing Buddha Dhamma, but they don't believe in the perfect enlightenment of the Buddha, then they're lacking in conviction. And so they don't have this good quality that enables them to be unshakable in the face of worldly conditions and worldly ideas. So this is very important because sometimes people don't quite understand this, that if you don't believe in the enlightenment of the perfect enlightenment of the Buddha in the Samma Sambodhi, then there are problems in one's practice. So in order to practice this, the Buddha gives the Itipiso Gatha, which is Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampano Sugato Lokavitu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manusanang Buddho Bhagavati. So in English this is, that blessed one is worthy, the perfectly enlightened one, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, knower of the worlds, unsurpassed trainer of people fit to be trained, the teacher of devas and humans, awakened, blessed. So clearly the right view of the Buddha's perfect enlightenment and his noble qualities are fundamental to having conviction, to having this saddha. And by understanding and recollecting each of these nine qualities, it helps us to grow in conviction towards the Buddha, the originator of this noble path. So let's briefly go through each quality of the Buddha to refresh our minds And afterwards, we'll do a short meditation on Buddha Anusati, so recollecting the Buddha. So Arahang, worthy. Buddha is worthy because he is the Tathagata, perfectly released from samsara. He has completely destroyed greed, hatred, and delusion, and all the associated defilements, and he's uprooted all the taints and severed the link to samsara. The second one is Sammasambuddho. So this is what we've been focusing on today. He's attained perfect release or liberation all on his own without a teacher by awakening to the Four Noble Truths. And also we know through his journey to become a Buddha, he's undergone many trials and renunciation and certain practices and, of course, fulfilling the 10 perfections. And then we have the third one, Vijja Charana Sampanno, so consummate in knowledge and conduct. So we know that he's perfected the 3 supreme knowledges, so Tavijja, and also the 15 good conduct, which makes him an accomplished one, a perfected one. So consummate in knowledge, this Vijja Sampanno, is really these 3 knowledges. So we know recollecting manifold past lives in their modes and details, also by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human eye. He sees beings passing away and reappearing, and he discerns how they are inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, in accordance with their karma. And the third one is by realizing for oneself with direct knowledge of the final truth, one enters and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the taint. And in terms of further supernormal knowledges or the abhinya, maybe the higher powers, the Buddha enjoys the wondrous gift in various modes. So there's things like having been one, he can become many. And having become many, he can manifest back to one. He can appear and vanish. He can go unimpeded through walls and ramparts and mountains and through space. He can dive in and out of the earth as if it were water. And he can walk on water without sinking as if it were earth. He can sit cross-legged, traveling through space like a winged bird. And with his hand, he touches and strokes the sun and the moon, so mighty and powerful. And he can exercise mastery of the body as far as the Brahma world. And of course, the divine ear, so this is clairaudience, hearing sounds both human and celestial, whether near or far away, and being able to know the thoughts of others, so essentially mind reading. And then when it comes to being accomplished in conduct, so this is Charana Sampanno, we know there are the 15 kinds of good conduct, so consummate in virtue, Sila Sampanno, guarding the doors to the sense faculties, Indriya Sugata Devaro, having moderation in eating, Bhojane Matanyu, wakefulness, so Jagriyang, and then of course conviction, which we've mentioned before, Saddha. Then they're the 2 protectors, which is moral shame, hiri, and fear of wrongdoing, otapa. And also hearing, having heard much, so bahusita, also sometimes translated as very learned. And then arada virya is being energetic or strenuous. And then we have sati, mindfulness, panya, being wise. And then the last 4 are the 4 form jhanas. So that's what makes up Vijja Charana Sampanno. Then the 4th one is Sugato, so well gone, fortunate. So the Buddha has traveled the correct path, the Noble Eightfold Path, was consummate in pleasant and impeccable manners, has habits that are impeccable, whether sitting, standing, walking, and the Buddha is endowed with an incomparable physical appearance. So we went through the 32 marks of a great man in our first session. And he's embodied selfless service for the safety and well-being of all living beings. So this is part of the parami that he's perfected. And he has great compassion. So this is the Mahakaruna. And great depth of insight, unique voice, sublime speech that is non-harmful, pleasant and welcoming. And for all these different qualities, he's greatly revered. So that's Sugato, well gone or fortunate. Then the 5th one is Lokavidu, which is knower of the worlds. So the Buddha has perfect knowledge of all worlds. their origins and cessations. And this could be the world of conditioned things, so sankhara loka. And so this comprises materiality as well as mentality, the world of beings, human beings, satta loka. And actually, this includes all 31 planes of existence. So the apayas, the human realm, the deva realms, the brahma loka, and the four immaterial states, and then all the world systems spread over immeasurable space and time. So that's Okasa Loka. Then the sixth one is Anuttaro Purusa Dhamma Sarati, so unsurpassed trainer of people to be trained. And sometimes this is a tamer of people fit to be tamed. That's another translation. We know from the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, this is Majjhima Nikaya Discourse number 137, it makes reference to the Buddha as the master trainer. He's said to be unexcelled, to be the unexcelled trainer of the people fit to be trained. And what it goes through is that there are trainers in the world who are like elephant trainers or horse trainers or ox trainers, and they can only proceed in one direction at a time, so east, west, north, or the south. But if one is trained by the fully awakened Buddha, a person in training proceeds in eight directions. And although this is like a temporary liberation, the Buddha can instruct in these things. So the mind gets temporarily released and a person delights in those meditation objects. And as trainees, when we apply ourselves in these eight different directions or liberations, then we're also said to reach some kind of attainment of perfect or special knowledge as well. And it's not Nibbana, but it's in the vicinity of Nibbana is what is said. The seventh quality is Sata Deva Manusanang, so teacher of divine and human beings. So depending on the mental capacity of the Buddha's human and divine students, the Buddha was able to teach them the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is for their benefit, both in this lifetime and in future lifetimes as well, in order to attain the ultimate goal of Nibbana and to escape from this whole mass of suffering and the cycle of birth and death, birth and death. And then the eighth quality is Buddho, which is awakened. So the Buddha was known as the awakened one. He realized the Four Noble Truths through his own efforts, and out of compassion, he would teach others. He knew all things to be known. He cultivated all things that needed to be cultivated, and he destroyed all things that needed to be destroyed. And the last quality is Bhagava, which is blessed. And the Buddha was known as the Blessed One, the highest of all beings endowed with supernormal and superhuman intellectual faculties, being able to expound the Dhamma so well, and venerated by human beings, celestial beings, and Brahmas. So these are the nine unique qualities of the Buddha, as we know as the Itipisogata. So what we can do now is to, on this auspicious Vesak day, to actually do a short meditation recollecting the Buddha and these qualities of the Buddha. When we do Buddha Anusati, we are endowed with conviction in the enlightenment of the Tathagata, and we recollect these accomplishments and these noble qualities. So let's do this meditation for a few minutes and allow the mind to suffuse with joy. Bring into the mind anything that has resonated from this session, or if you attended the earlier session this morning, and allow the mind to be happy and to be calm. So let's do Buddha Anusati for a few minutes, and I'll bring us out when it's time to come out of the meditation. Blessings of the Triple Gem. Okay, we can come out of our meditation. So lovely to recollect the Buddha. It's a wonderful feeling to feel so fortunate to be able to encounter the Buddha's teachings and to make progress on the path. There's something very warm and grateful about being fortunate in that way. So given that it's an auspicious Vesak day, it's good to briefly touch on noble aspiration and connect conviction and saddha with aspiration. So the Pali word that is used in this particular sutta is sampakandana, which translates as aspiration. So in the questions of King Malinda, in this Sampakandana Lakana Saddapanha, which is the king asking Venerable Nagasena, and how is aspiration the sign of conviction? And Venerable Nagasena says, just as one who develops spiritual practice, having seen how the minds of others have been released, aspires to enter upon the fruit of stream entry, or the fruit of once returning, or the fruit of non-returning, or to realize arahantship itself, and applies oneself to the attainment of what he has not yet reached, to the experience of what he has not yet felt, to the realization of what he has not yet realized. Thus, this aspiration is the sign of conviction. So there's this misconception that noble aspiration is not something that is wholesome, that it's about becoming something or identifying with a sense of self, something that is rooted in me and mine, or craving some kind of existence. But when we look at this answer, and there are other suttas as well, noble aspiration is considered a wholesome wish that is certainly a sign of conviction towards the understanding of the perfectly enlightened Buddha. And with that understanding, wishing for liberation from this whole mass of suffering. So it's very wholesome because it's associated with the ending of karma, the ending of suffering. You can see that by the fruits of attainment. And the Noble Eightfold Path will have been fully developed by the Buddhas and also the noble disciples. And we also see this reflected in the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha talks about renunciant sadness. And when we have aspirations regarding being able to attain to the path, the Buddha references renunciant sadness as something that is better than household sadness when we make losses on the stock market or something terrible happens in terms of household life. So it's very important to recognize that when we have the correct development of saddha, this conviction, this faith, rooted faith, then this noble aspiration is something that manifests as a wholesome thing. Now, many of us are guilty of knowingly or unknowingly praising the wrong kinds of people or blaming those deserving of praise. And in Dhamma, it happens a lot, where people praise, as we said earlier, philosophers, scientists, celebrities, royalty, modern meditation masters, unattained monks and nuns, unattained lay teachers, above the perfectly enlightened Buddha, and also the noble ones who have attained arahantship. And for Buddhists, when you recall the Sammasambuddha Sutta, the Gopaka Moggallana Sutta, and the Uttara Vipatti Sutta, these are the three suttas we examined at the start of this particular session, the Buddha is the originator of the path, while everyone else is the follower of the path, coming after the Buddha. And even at the time of the Buddha, there wasn't a single bhikkhu or bhikkhuni who possessed in each and every way all the qualities of the Buddha. And whatever is well spoken is all the words of the Blessed One, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. So when we make value judgments, comparisons that belittle noble ones, and many people unfortunately aren't aware of the dire consequences of such actions. So when you go onto Dhamma forums and write certain things and think that that's okay, there are actually dire consequences for things like that. And it's really good to put a stop sign, to not venture into areas where there are consequences like that. And so if you remember the Portelier Sutta that we went through a couple of weeks ago on noble retirement, at the end of that discourse, Portelier, the householder, he admits to these kinds of transgressions. What he says to the Buddha at the end of that discourse is, "For Venerable Sir, though the wanderers of other sects are not thoroughbreds, we imagine that they are thoroughbreds. Though they are not thoroughbreds, we fed them the food of thoroughbreds. Though they are not thoroughbreds, we set them in the place of thoroughbreds. We set them in the place of thoroughbreds. But though the bhikkhus are thoroughbreds, we imagine that they are not thoroughbreds. Though they are thoroughbreds, we fed them the food of those who are not thoroughbreds. Though they are thoroughbreds, who set them in the place of those who are not thoroughbreds." And so Portelier, the householder, was very fortunate to make amends to the Buddha himself. So there's this one teaching that we're going to look at now, which is in two suttas. It's called Pathamakatha Sutta. This is in Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 4, discourse number 3. But then there's also the Turu Brahma Sutta, which is Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 6, discourse number 9. Both are the same teaching and they're very beneficial to us. So the Buddha says, "He who praises one deserving of blame or blames one deserving praise casts with his mouth an unlucky throw by which he finds no happiness. Slight is the unlucky throw at dice that results in the loss of one's wealth, the loss of all, oneself included. Much worse is this unlucky throw of harboring hate against the fortunate ones. For more than 2 quinquadecillion years and another 5 quatuordecillion years, the slanderer of noble ones goes to hell, having defamed them with evil speech and mind." And so someone who doesn't have right view about karma and rebirth will probably denounce this kind of statement from the Buddha. But those with right view who understand karma and rebirth will look at this teaching and probably start to look at transgressions. And when one praises people that are deserving of blame or blames one deserving of praise, and the Buddha says, "Cast with his mouth an unlucky throw by which he finds no happiness," then when you write these things out in Dhamma forums or speak up about them openly, then this is something that you accrue demerits. And at the same time, if one thinks in this way, it's also something that is very unfortunate as well. So the Buddha is very clear here that the slanderer of noble ones goes to hell, having defamed them with evil speech and mind. So it's rather shocking, but I think it's important to declare and to make it known, because I think a lot of us are knowingly and unknowingly in danger of this. And it's good to put up the stop sign to actually say, well, maybe I don't need to think in this way. Maybe I don't need to express myself in this way. Maybe I don't need to write these things out in public forums or even in private forums. So that's something to think about. The other one that's useful to look at is this slandering the Tathagata. And in the Balavagga, so this is in Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 2, discourse number 23 to 24, the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, these two slander the Tathagata." Which two? "The first is one who explains what has not been stated and uttered by the Tathagata as having been stated and uttered by the Tathagata. And the second is one who explains what has been stated and uttered by the Tathagata as not having been stated and uttered by the Tathagata. These two slander the Tathagata." So this is a pretty strong statement, particularly after what we've just gone through about slandering noble ones, which would include the Tathagata. So an example for this, a very simple example, could be about fake Buddha quotes that we see all across the internet and sending those sorts of things around, things that have not been stated or uttered by the Buddha, or even declaring something as having been stated but hasn't been stated by the Buddha, or vice versa. Another example could be teaching or sharing Dhamma and teaching it under the banner of the Buddha, saying one is Buddhist, one practices Buddhism, maybe one is ordained or what have you. But the teaching is grounded in the wrong view. So one would say the Buddha teaches about eternalism, for example, but maybe not call it eternalism, but essentially what is being taught is that, which was refuted by the Buddha. So that's another example. And it could also be about a nihilism or other things like that. And then also in Balavaka, the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, these two slander the Tathagata. Which two? The first is one who explains a discourse whose meaning requires interpretation as a discourse whose meaning is explicit, and one who explains a discourse whose meaning is explicit as a discourse whose meaning requires interpretation. So one example could be taking the Buddha's teaching on karma and rebirth. And the meaning of karma and rebirth is actually quite explicit because the Buddha is very clear in quite a few suttas about karma and all its different things. And it's also part of right view. And then someone comes along and through some kind of interpretation or rearrangement makes it as if karma and rebirth is obsolete in the Buddha's teaching. So that's one example. I mean, these particular ones are actually quite difficult to see whether one actually slanders the Buddha, because even when you share Dhamma, there's always a risk that you over embellish or you assign a meaning that isn't quite right and things of that nature. So it's really good to investigate either way these four things and to really look at it, because most of the time we can do this out of ignorance or out of conceit. And so it's really good to practice and include it in our practice to examine this. And if we slander the Tathagata, it can really obstruct our spiritual path. And as a rule of thumb, like if I can share from my own personal practice, due to sharing Dhamma, I tend to regularly ask for forgiveness of the Triple Gem to make amends in accordance with the Dhamma. So when we better understand how difficult it is to become a Buddha, the long periods of time spent fulfilling the 10 perfections, we can come to realize how much we are like little infants compared to the noble ones, little babies. And so over time, I found it particularly helpful to remove obstructions by humbling myself to the noble ones, to admit transgressions, even in doubt, and to ask for forgiveness. Now, transgressions is not something that is often spoken about and encouraged in terms of being able to address them, but I really like this particular sutta, which is the Acheya Sutta. And in this, in terms of today being Vesak Day, I thought it would be very beneficial for us to consider our transgressions and then to make amends together. So the Buddha says in this Acheya Sutta, Bhikkhus, one who possesses three qualities should be known as a fool. What three? He does not see his transgressions as a transgression. Two, when he sees his transgression as a transgression, he does not make amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma. And three, when another person confesses a transgression to him, he does not accept it in accordance with the Dhamma. One who possesses three qualities should be known as a wise person. What three? So a wise person sees a transgression as a transgression. Two, when he sees a transgression as a transgression, he makes amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma. And three, when another person confesses a transgression to him, he accepts it in accordance with the Dhamma. Therefore, it is in this way you should train yourselves. So if we are wise, then we will follow the steps of admitting, and then we will also make amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma by asking forgiveness or confessing to a good friend or teacher. And then we will also accept another person's confession in accordance with the Dhamma if they should come to us. Now, as we know from the Kosambya Sutta, if one admits transgressions, then this is a sign of one ready to attain to stream entry, or if one has already attained to the fruit of the path. So this is a very important part of the practice because it's around purification in support of developing the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's possible to make amends by confessing to another person. So it could be asking forgiveness of a teacher or the Triple Gem or a good friend. And when you ask forgiveness of the triple gem, this can be done in Pali, which is on the left, as well as in English. But it's important to understand the words and what they mean. So in English, we say, if by body, speech or mind, due to negligence, I have done any wrongdoing, forgive me of that fault, Venerable Sir, the Enlightened One of Abundant Wisdom. And then, if by body, speech or mind, due to negligence, I have done any wrongdoing, forgive me of that fault, Dhamma, visible in this life and immediate. And then the third part of the gatha is, if by body, speech or mind, due to negligence, I have done any wrongdoing, forgive me of that fault, Sangha, unsurpassed field of merit. So just to give an example, I ask for forgiveness of the triple gem regularly. I usually do it before sitting to meditate. Occasionally I do it before walking meditation, but I also definitely do it before sharing Dhamma, and I do it also after sharing Dhamma. And if I go to gatherings, I usually also ask forgiveness after coming back from gathering. So you get this kind of idea that when you include it as part of your practice and you see the merit of it as well, it's part of the purification process and also part of admitting that there is still a lot of ignorance in our practice. And so if you wish to remove obstructions from the path and you can see that we are constantly colliding and constantly making mistakes because we're not perfected, then this is a very good encouragement towards admitting transgressions and to make amends in accordance with the Dhamma. So I would encourage that even after this session, if it naturally resonates with you to, on this auspicious Vesak day, to actually ask for forgiveness, to admit some transgressions and to actually ask for forgiveness. So I'd like to end our session with the Buddha's words from the Sisapavana Sutta. So this is a very famous teaching of the Buddha. So this is in Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 56, discourse number 31. And this is to encourage us, along with all these other things that we've covered today, to arouse energy and to exert ourselves to the Noble Eightfold Path. So the Buddha says, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in a Sinsapa grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Sinsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the bhikkhus thus, what do you think, bhikkhus, which is more numerous, these few Sinsapa leaves that I've taken in my hand or those in the Sinsapa grove overhead? And of course the bhikkhus say, Venerable Sir, the Sinsapa leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the Sinsapa grove overhead are numerous. And then the Buddha says, so too, bhikkhus, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, bhikkhus, have I not taught those many things? And it's because they are unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life or holy life, and do not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, I have not taught them. And what bhikkhus have I taught? I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why bhikkhus have I taught this? Because this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and leads to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, I have taught this. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So, an exertion towards the Four Noble Truths. So, even in this closing sutta that we look at, we can see that the Blessed One is very, very perfected in terms of knowledges, insights, and wisdom. And what he's taught us is not his whole suite of knowledge. In fact, what he's taught us is a handful of leaves, and he's saying to us, this is sufficient. So we've now come to the end of our session, part two of our live stream on the Tathagata. I hope you felt joy and the mind has been uplifted on this Vesak day. So let's now express in our minds gratitude to the Buddha for these powerful teachings. Let's also express gratitude to our other teachers, parents, good friends who encourage us on the Noble Eightfold Path. And again, I would like to express gratitude, Bohoma Ping Anumodana, to the Kalyanamitas who helped with contributions of research towards today's Dhammadana. And if you would like to dedicate the merit from joining this Dhamma session to any departed relatives, you can do so now. And we can share the merits of our wholesome time together with all sentient beings. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering. Blessings of the Triple Gem to all of you. Wishing you all well. May you grow in wholesome qualities. May you find happiness in the Buddha's teachings and continue to develop on the Noble Eightfold Path.